welcome to A Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, as well as CFRC. So thank you very much to both of them. Now, if your mates miss the show at any time, you know you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or CFRC podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, I would like to introduce you to Dakota Urban, who is doing a Master of Arts in Classics and Archaeology under the supervision of Drs. Jan Mathieu Carbon and Richard Askoff. Welcome to Grad Chat, Dakota.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You know what? It's interesting. The very first classics student we interviewed here was back in the very first year in 2016, and she was the second person I interviewed.
That's awesome.
It is awesome. And she was doing a little bit of archaeology classics too, but yeah. And I remember then how fascinating it was, and anything like, I mean, I love history and stuff anyway, yeah. So it's a natural fit for me, really.
Nice.
But, you know, that was 2016, and what are we now, 2023? So it's nice to have another classics person come onto the show, so thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you.
Now, Dakota, you did your undergrad at Guelph in classics.
Yes.
Was it classics and archaeology, just classics?
Just classics.
Just classics. And what made you do that? Because classics, a lot of people think, oh, you know, some of people think just history. Some think, oh, that's the ancient world. Is it relevant for today? What made you want to get into the area of classics?
Yeah, so I actually started as an English major for the first couple of years, but I wasn't really intrigued by what I was studying. I then took a classics course just as an elective.
Right.
And I ended up having a professor that was...
inspirational.
Yeah, super inspirational, very enthusiastic in his lectures. And that was just, that passion was contagious. And so I ended up switching and just falling in love with the research.
So what is classics?
Classics is the study of ancient history. So it mainly focuses on Greece and Rome, but obviously there's other cultures that existed at that time period.
Which I remember going through high school was pretty fascinating as well. In fact, I probably was better at that than other topics that I took. And so then you decided you wanted to continue doing classics as a master's. And unfortunately, we only have a master's program in classics and archaeology here at Queen's. Well. But it's great that you're doing that. And so as you said, You know, classics is more about the Roman and Greek times, which I guess then that sort of speaks to some of the things that you're wanting to do in your research. And I'll just let people know your research topic. First of all, master's is a short program. Any master's are short. It's 1 or 2 years. I mean, your research topic is transcultural language in diasporic Jewish inscriptions.
Yes.
Before you go into explaining what you're trying to do there, why this period of the Jewish and Greek and Hebrew Roman times?
Well, this is from the Hellenistic period to the imperial period. This is a time where the majority of Jews were living in the diaspora.
Right.
So they were living under Greco-Roman influence and authority. So it's a particularly interesting time to study that relationship between the two cultures.
Okay, so explain a bit more. What are you trying to do?
So yeah, I'm looking at diasporic Jewish communities as a cultural minority in the Greco-Roman world, and I'm exploring how the diasporic Jews adapted to different contexts in their environment while also cultivating their identity in this environment and making their identity accessible to non-Jews.
Right. So before you go on, just to make sure people understand, explain what diaspora means.
Diaspora is outside of Judea, where the Judeans come from. There were settlements across the Greco-Roman world. So this is the periphery of Judea, where the Jewish settlements were relocated.
So it's like it's not their necessarily their original, but they've set up other areas.
Yeah, they've either been exiled from their homeland or there's been voluntary migration to different parts of the Greco-Roman world.
Right. Okay.
No, so the way that I'm exploring this relationship between Jews and Greeks is through transcultural language on inscriptions. So I'm looking at how the language used in these inscriptions expresses the Jewish identity in a manner that fits both the boundaries of Judaism and also the larger societal structures of the Greco-Roman world.
Okay, well, that's going to be tricky. And I guess that's where, may I even say, the archaeology type stuff comes in if you look at that. Because if you're looking at inscriptions, are you finding, first of all, these inscriptions on paper, papyrus, or on stone? Or where are you finding these inscriptions?
These inscriptions are on stone. Luckily, there are databases that we can access the majority of these inscriptions. So that's where I get the information from.
And so you said you're looking at the transcultural side, the complexity of that. So if I'm understanding this correctly, the writings at that time from the Jewish settlements have a combination of Judaism and maybe Greek or Roman embedded to be able to make people understand the culture, both if you're Jewish or whether you're Roman or Greek. Or is it a fit in?
Yeah, definitely. So I'm looking at Jewish communities as a minority culture because that's what they were.
Yes.
And so they had to accommodate themselves to fit the larger structures of the society so that they could participate in the society and be recognized in the society. So the predominant language of diasporic Jews was Greek. So the transcultural language...
So it wasn't Hebrew?
No, Hebrew died out until around the 4th century CE.
Oh, okay.
So these inscriptions are in Greek, and the language that I'm referring to as transcultural language is Greek language that is conceptually accessible to Jews and Greeks.
Okay. So that's a bit tricky, is it? Or not?
Well, it requires a certain level of peeling back the layers of the language and the different meanings. So I contextualize the language in a Jewish setting, in a pagan setting, which is Greek or Roman, and then I try and look at the language outside of that dichotomy. So how is this language appealing to both groups?
To both. Yeah. Well, that would be interesting because you'd see certain words that mean something to one and do they still mean the same in the other culture?
Yeah.
So trying to figure that out. So do you know Greek?
Yeah, well, my Greek is okay. It's luckily, these inscriptions are very small. So with enough patience, I can decipher the inscriptions. And luckily, the inscriptions that I'm looking at are quite formulaic. So you translate one and then you have the answer for the other inscriptions with tiny little tweaks here and there.
Okay. So is the Greek language back then the same as what it is now?
No, there's differences.
There is differences now. So it's changed as the hundreds of years have gone by.
Yeah.
So to speak. So with some of the things that you're looking at, how did diasporic Jewish communities in the Greco-Roman world, whereas we know at that stage, and as you mentioned, pagan religion was embedded in all sectors of life, how did they participate in the structures of the majority culture without compromising their own religious and cultural identity? Because we see that in Canada, right? We have immigrants coming over and you want to keep your own cultural identity, but you also want to fit in.
Yeah, 100%. So there's this ongoing process that we see in relationships between Jews and Greeks and Romans, and that's the process of acculturation and enculturation. So acculturation is the integration into a society, but it's selective. You're not completely absorbed into the majority culture. You can adopt and adapt, but also refuse certain foreign elements to a certain extent. So for example, Jews adopted the Greek language, but they didn't give up some of their traditional practices, such as circumcision.
Right.
There's then the aspect of enculturation, which is the active retention of one's own culture and the active engagement with that culture. So we find with the diasporic Jewish communities this ability to create a common ground where they were able to participate in the majority structures. So they were considered, to a certain extent, Greek, but they didn't cease to be authentically Jewish.
So their religion. So when you say authentically Jewish, it's the religion that stayed, or is more than just religion?
Well, so actually, the term Jewish didn't exist in antiquity. It was Judeos, okay. Which is just means Judean, and there is the view in scholarship that we can't apply that religious connotation to that Greek term, that it's just an ethnic identifier for right. the Judeans. But there is a religion and culture and ethnicity are intertwined in the mm-hmm. Jewish identity and in Judaism. So, yeah, there is a tie between religion and culture. They are ethnically identified from where they came, whether that's their ancestors came from Judea or they themselves came from Judea. But there is that self-consciousness in the Jewish identity that there is a longing to return to the promised homeland, because part of their religion is a promised return to their ancestral homeland.
Okay.
So we can't ignore that religious connotation that is a part of the Greek term Judeos, meaning Judean. The Jewish Hellenistic authors speak a lot about this longing to return and the religious elements that are intertwined in their cultural and ethnic identity.
So with some of the things that you're looking at in these inscriptions, does it show an internal conflict with themselves of how much do they take on the cultures of where they're currently living without, as you said, without compromising their final belief is at some stage, I am going to be returning home?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. There definitely is an internal conflict. How much do you take on and how much do you retain? We find that the Jews have this ability to accommodate themselves and their identity to fit these structures. And one of the models of looking at Jewish identity in antiquity is looking at the Jews as perpetually changing in their identity, whether that's religious or cultural. Now, that doesn't mean that they're fundamentally changing aspects of their tradition, but that they are able to adapt and that they are fluid and mobile in the boundaries that they have.
It's almost going back to some of the nomadic lives and things that people can be yeah. moving, and it doesn't matter actually where they're residing. It's more about, are we ourselves as an identity, as a group, keeping our identity?
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
So you mentioned this word transcultural language. So what is, I mean, and a little bit about what transcultural language is, but in what circumstances is it used?
Yeah, transcultural language is an idea that derives from the concept of cultural translation, which has three competing definitions in different fields of study.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Just what you need, right, when you've got a short master's degree.
Yeah. So in anthropology, cultural translation is the act of describing one culture to another culture
right.
through textual documents. In cultural studies, it refers to the forms of negotiation that people engage in when they've been displaced from one culture to another.
Right.
And in translation studies, it is the act of not only translating one language into another language, but translating the cultural concepts of one language in a way that those concepts are accessible to the targeted language.
Right.
And so in each one of these circumstances, what we have is one culture making their understanding of the world and their values and traditions accessible to another culture. And this requires the creation of a common ground, or some scholars call it a third space.
Right.
And in this third space, there needs to be a language that is conceptually accessible to both cultures or the multiple
cultures. To all
yeah,
parties.
All parties, yeah, mm-hmm. for sure. So that's the idea of transcultural language. Is language that when these, in relation to my thesis, when Jewish and Greek communities are negotiating at the boundaries of their identity, it's language that is conceptually accessible to both of them. So there's a term, Theos Hypsistos, which means the Most High God. And it's found in both Jewish and Greek culture, also Christian culture. Because it is relatively anonymous, I mean, it doesn't name what God is most high. When we find it in dedications or invocations on inscriptions, and when there isn't an identifier on the inscription to tell us which culture is invoking the most high God,
right,
it's difficult to determine who is invoking the God.
Speaking.
So this has led to debate in scholarship. Some people think, well, Theos Hypsistos is a single deity of a syncretic, unified, pagan-Jewish hybrid religion. I disagree with this, and so do other scholars, because we have evidence of distinctively Jewish usages of the term. So we have, in some of the inscriptions that I'm looking at, not an invocation to Theos Hypsistos, but to Theos Hypsistos eulogetois pantokrator, which is the Most High God, Blessed Almighty. Blessed in the Greek and in the modern term, in the English modern term, is distinctively Jewish. I mean, it occurs in throughout Jewish prayers. Baruch Atah Adonai, right? That's blessed.
Oh, I know that one, yes.
Yeah, for sure.
I did that at summer camp.
Oh, yeah? So that's a distinctively Jewish epithet. And Pantokrator is used in sometimes in Greek culture, but mainly in Jewish and Christian culture. So what we have here is a distinctively Jewish usage of this transcultural term, Theos Hypsistos. On the other side of that, we have distinctively non-Jewish usages of Theos Hypsistos. And this is, we find in inscriptions on the stelae that they are inscribed on, there's either a description of the god's image, or there is a relief that depicts the god, or in one of the instances, we have a fragmented bronze foot on top of the altar. And this is an inconceivable notion in Jewish tradition. You can't, you don't worship the image of the god. So this can't be Jewish. This can't be a syncretic religion, because this is inconceivable in Jewish thought. And so what I argue is that Theos Hypsistos is a transcultural term that is conceptually accessible to both parties in a common religious ground. So Jews and Greeks knew that their God was the Most High, but also that there also existed another culture that believed their God was the Most High.
Right. Makes it tricky, though, for today, with you having to go and figure out, so which one are we talking about there? But I guess the point is, it doesn't matter which one. Whoever is speaking at the time will know which one they mean.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
So is transcultural language an effective tool or mode of analysis for investigating how the diasporic Jewish communities articulated their religion in a pagan world?
Yes, I think it is an effective model because, first of all, it demonstrates the level of integration that Jewish communities participated in. And it also demonstrates a retention of their identity. So it further disproves archaic or earlier scholarship that suggested that the Jewish adoption of foreign practices equated to syncretism or complete assimilation, which is the complete absorption into another culture or the fusion of religions. Looking at transcultural language allows us to see the fluidity of the Jewish identity and the duality of it in the processes of acculturation and enculturation.
So with this, with your findings and whatever your final results are, what are you hoping to do? Just prove the point that it's there? Are you hoping that another scholar can look at how you've analyzed the Jewish diaspora and use it in other groups? Because a lot of times we look at models.
Yeah.
You know, if it works for this, does it work for this? And are you hoping then that other groups can come in and say, well, you know, well, that was a good point, and you found your work on these stone inscriptions. Maybe there's other things like that that we can look at.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, some of the models that I am employing have already been established. So I am using, to a certain extent, some theoretical precursors. But yeah, I think this is, looking specifically at language, is a way to see how minority cultures interacted with the majority culture.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it can be applied. I mean, we can use it in today's understanding how minority cultures interact with majority cultures.
Well, I just think about too, here in Canada with our indigenous languages that are getting revitalized because they're potentially lost, but how much was lost? Even with the revitalization, is it still picking up the stuff from before Europeans arrived, or is it from Europeans or the last 100 years, that kind of thing?
Yeah, that's very interesting. Yeah, that's an interesting investigation.
Because I think we could do that with a lot of cultures.
Yeah, definitely.
Around the world that have moved around. I know even just any immigrant. Mm-hmm. I've moved around the world in all sorts of places, but there's certain things that I want to keep of me. But I know I've picked up a lot of terminology from around the world. And at times I get confused. Was that do I say project or project? And what was the initial? Because I forget. Is it garage or garage? Little words like that. And I know it's just language as opposed to a particular culture, but it's come from where I was born. I still remember that. Then in England, then going to Australia, which Australia is a bit British. It's trying to be a bit American. It's trying to be a bit of everything.
Yeah. Yeah. Language is the way that you make your culture accessible to others. So for sure, it's an important aspect of that.
So what else do you want to do with this? Is it a fascination for you on how, I mean, you clearly love classics. Is it a fascination in classics of looking at the Jewish culture moving forward? Is it just because that was an easy one because of these inscriptions that you found and we know the Jewish community or the Judeans went to lots of different places, particularly around that time, for you to be able to look at? You know, is it you wanting to continue looking at how that movement happened, or is it you think about something else next time?
Yeah, no, I'm definitely intrigued by ancient Judaism and the interactions between Jews and the Greco-Roman society. I also think that this could be applied to other groups in antiquity, so that could be interesting. I do like the religious aspect of looking at Jews and Greeks. So that is, I'm not sure where it's leading to, but it'll be fascinating.
Can you separate the religious part to the cultural?
No, I don't think so. Religion
they are
was,
really intertwined, aren't they?
Yeah, they are in both societies, Judaism and the pagan society, yes.
And what else are you hoping to find out from these inscriptions? Is there anything else that's popped out from these inscriptions that you weren't expecting to see?
There's so much room for interpretation in some of the clauses that we find on these inscriptions, and there is still a great amount of debate in the scholarship.
Right.
So that's been a surprise is how we're still able to be having these conversations about the context of the inscriptions when they've been studied for years.
Right. Do we know who wrote did these inscriptions in the first place? Because was it a religious person? Was it an everyday person in the street that wrote these inscriptions on stone? Who wrote them? Because that would tell us a lot too when we're looking at how to interpret them. Because as we know, even with Bibles or the Torah, it's written by, I don't know about the Torah, but I know the Bible, lots of different people. And which one do we choose? Is it this version or is it this version?
Yeah, so there would have been individuals who were trained to create the inscriptions. But in terms of identifying culture or religion, we have a list of criteria that we can use to determine whether or not the inscriptions are Jewish. In terms of the religiosity of the individual who the inscription belongs to or is describing, that's quite difficult.
It might not even be a religious person. It could be someone in the government that's writing this, but someone writing from a government's perspective could be very different to you and me writing.
Yeah, I mean, so the inscriptions that I look at, I'll give an example. I'm looking at manumission inscriptions. These are documents that describe the conditions of a slave's release. They're very formulaic. They are, these particular ones that I'm looking at, are quite similar to other Greek manumission inscriptions that we see, but they're clearly Jewish based off of some of the terminology that's used
right.
in the inscription. So, for example, the witnesses of the transaction, the release of the slave, is the Synagogue of Judeans. So that tells us that
right.
the Judeans are involved, that the Jewish community is involved. And the slave is actually released in some of these inscriptions at a prosuke, which is a prayer house used in a Jewish context.
Right.
So we can determine to a certain extent who's involved in the inscriptions.
But it doesn't really tell us of what's going on in that time because, again, it's one person's, even though it is structured and maybe like it is in other things, so this is what's happening on today. This was the transaction, so to speak. It's a horrible word, transaction.
Oh, yes, yeah.
You know, that sort of thing. So the fact it happened in a synagogue or something, could it easily have happened in the city hall?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, yeah, there is definitely a level of interpretation required mm-hmm. when we're studying these inscriptions. There's definitely potentially too much of an Eddic perspective when we study these inscriptions.
Right, yes.
So, yeah, they could have happened in different locations.
Yeah, it's always going to be tricky because unless you're actually there, you don't know for sure, do you?
No, 100%, yeah.
Because we know how truths and things can be changed.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a...
And I'm not saying that these are incorrect, but just from today's standards.
No, for sure, a level of interpretation is required. And mm-hmm. I mean, how much leeway you have in that interpretation. I mean, to a certain extent, because we're specifically in my research, I'm looking at language, so I right. can't change the meaning of words.
No.
But yeah, in terms of the broader context, there is interpretation.
Does that worry you, though, knowing, you know, I'm basing my work on this, for instance, one piece of information that I'm given. And is that an outlier piece of information or is it the norm? Or does that worry you? Because as an academic, so to speak, if you're putting something out, people expecting the truth, now you can only go by what you've got in front of you. But does that worry you?
No, because what I'm doing is I'm not just looking at the inscription itself. I'm looking at the inscription within a corpus of inscriptions. I'm looking at a different inscriptions where, let's say, a specific term appears in this inscription. I look at the term in other inscriptions, in other literature, how is it used right. in different contexts? So I am contextualizing the information and comparing it with other places that it appears. So yeah, there is a level of interpretation that I'm applying to my work, but also it is backed up. There are sources that right. suggest, yes, what I'm saying is
from
the
what,
truth.
From what we know,
yeah.
from this, this, and this.
Yes, exactly.
You can only work with what you've got.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as you say, from what here is,
yeah,
the interpretation is this.
Yeah, exactly.
As opposed to it's carte blanche.
No, 100%. Yeah.
Not easy to do, no. is it?
No.
Well, let's get on to something a little bit different.
Okay.
You're an amateur boxer.
Yes.
What made you want to do boxing, other than it's a great fitness outlet?
There was nothing in particular. I mean, I just picked it up one day. We had a heavy bag in the basement, and I was just...
You had some frustrations?
Yeah, I was 16. I was going through stuff, you know. So, yeah, I just picked it up, and I fell in love with it. Much like classics, it was just an accident.
But are you still doing that?
Yeah, I train regularly. I drive to Brockville 4 times a week to train, and I compete semi-regularly.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah.
That's very well. Best of luck with that.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay. I'm glad you're doing it and not me.
Yeah.
But if nothing else, it's a great outlet for physical activity, isn't it? I mean, you can burn a lot of calories doing that.
Yeah, for sure. it also instills a great amount of discipline, which I think translates into being in academia. You have to have a level of discipline.
That's true. I often find people who are into sport can manage time and everything a lot better than others because you have to, because if you want to do your training, you got to fit it in around everything else.
Exactly.
Because unless you're full time, then it makes it a little harder. But and even if it is full time, there's still that discipline of getting up each morning and doing it.
Yeah,
100%. You can't just say, well, I don't feel like it today.
Yeah, it doesn't work that way.
No, it doesn't. Well, Dakota, thank you very much for coming on the show. Like I said, I know it's only a master's program, but it seems like you've done an awful lot in that short time to be able to come up with eventually you'll be defending it and then hopefully people will get to hear a little bit more about this because, as you said, it is something that's not just restricted necessarily to the Jewish community. There are other diasporic communities out there as well, and we can sort of see how that's all working. So good luck with all of that.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for the conversation.
Excellent.
Appreciate it.
So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just type in a Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Science.